is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast. I'm Buster Olney, and Troy Farkas is producing back in Bristol. It's Tuesday, November 19, 2019, the latest off-season episode that we're putting together. And Troy, Thanksgiving next week. Tell me, what is the one must-have thing on the table at Thanksgiving for you?
Man, I am a sucker for mashed sweet potatoes. That is my... that's my favorite side dish, and that's what Thanksgiving and holidays are all about. It's the side dishes. Those are the stars of the show. Obviously, you're going to have turkey as your core piece, or some people go with a tofurkey, which is like a fake turkey. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but I'm all about my sweet potatoes.
Yeah, and I tell you what, if you had my mashed potatoes, then they would replace your sweet potatoes.
Really?
That's the one thing I must have. Yes, I can cook some potatoes.
Really, Buster? Like,
heck yeah, you know, whatever. 90% Irish and a lot of heritage there, and, you know, taught how to peel potatoes and cook potatoes from a young age. I can make myself some potatoes. Nothing else, but I can make some potatoes.
Well, I think one day we might have to arrange, you know, our foodie Bleacher Tweet Arena Benina is a big fan of eating, and she may have to have a sample my sweet potatoes and your potatoes, and we'll see who the winner is.
Okay, we just can't tell her which one is, well, I guess we kind of already gave it away. All right, lots to get to today. We're going to be talking with Tim Kirchen. We'll be talking with Mark Teixeira. We're going to hit a lot on this scandal involving the Houston Astros and sign stealing. Some news and notes. First, the Braves made the first big move of this offseason, signing free agent closer Will Smith to a 3-year deal for $39 million. There's an additional club option for $13 million for 2023. Smith had 34 saves last year and 38 opportunities for the San Francisco Giants. On Monday, the Pirates named Ben Cherington their general manager. Last week, the Giants formally named Gabe Kapler as their manager, and he talked about what he learned when he was the manager of the Phillies.
In my first year as a Phillies manager in 2018, I thought a lot about every little strategic edge, every little strategic advantage, and sometimes at the expense of some of that confidence that we've talked about. And my biggest learn was sometimes the confidence, a confident player is a better baseball player, and that outweighs the strategic advantage you get of calling just the right pitch at the right time.
And as I referenced, boy, since our last podcast, lots and lots and lots of stories about sign stealing. In particular, that sign stealing done by the Houston Astros, as confirmed by Mike Fiers, pitcher who was on the Astros, to The Athletic. The Athletic was the first to report on this story. Jeff Passan was the first to report that Kevin Goldstein, a special assistant to the Astros, asked scouts via email to spy on opponents' dugouts leading up to the 2017 postseason. Everybody in baseball is reacting to this, including Alex Rodriguez, who was on the Michael Kay Show, 98.7 ESPN New York, talking about whether or not he's seen a situation like the Astros.
I've never heard of this type of stuff, in fairness, I just don't have enough information to go really deep. But look, we are in 2019 going to 2020. There's so much technology, cameras. You always have to hedge and play defense. I would always encourage our catchers to have multiple signs, whether there's a man on second or nobody on. You have to pretend that somebody is always trying, Big Brother's always watching, and you have to be careful with that.
Alex talked about the Astros and whether or not they may have gone too far.
There's some things that are undefendable. If you're wiretap somebody's locker room or the other manager, there's stuff that you just cannot defend against. And if there's a center field camera that can pick up and slow down what signs are being given, any of that stuff, to me, that's on the, you know, not kosher side.
Yeah, and other teams believe that the Astros have used the computer system, used the computers to break down catching signs in real time. And then, of course, having that information forwarded to the hitter in real time. Brian Cashman, the Yankees general manager, was on the Michael Kay Show. He, of course, was the GM of the team when it went to the 2017 American League Championship Series and lost to the Astros. He was asked for his immediate reaction.
Clearly, it's on Major League Baseball's front burner now. Their antenna is up, and they will do their job and fully investigate. And I think based on all that, my best interest is no comment. I'd rather not participate more in what's going to play out is, you know, a very concerning story.
He was asked if the Yankees have ever filed grievances against the Astros.
I'm not going to comment on anything with this story currently or potential side stories. So obviously there's more than one person that stepped up, former players, one with the Houston Astros and Fiers put their name to it with some strong statements, and that's not my job. It's in the hand, that's in the hands of the commissioner's office and their personnel, and so I'm just not going to comment.
The Astros beat the Dodgers in the 2017 World Series, and Andrew Friedman, the Dodgers president of baseball ops, talked about the Astros investigation.
I mean, obviously, I read the article yesterday. I have followed the Twitterverse, who's doing a lot of investigative work. You know, it's something from my standpoint that, being that we were directly involved, it's hard for me to expound much on it. I know MLB is investigating it. I think it's really important that they investigate it. It will be interesting to see, you know, what comes out from that. And then I think once we have more clarity, I think it'll be more appropriate for me to comment in more detail.
And on Monday, the 2020 Hall of Fame ballot was released. A lot of conversation about that. Let's get to it.
Seam heads rejoice.
Nerd alert!
It's Timmy time.
Is this a great game or what?
With Tim Kirkchian on Baseball Tonight.
And Tim Kirkchian covers baseball for ESPN. Tim, how you doing?
I'm well, Buster. How's it going?
I'm doing okay, but I get the feeling I'm starting to go through some baseball withdrawal because I want to tell you about a dream that I had last night, and I'm not kidding about any of what I'm about ready to tell you, okay? The dream that I had last night was seeing you in a hotel hallway, and as you and I are talking, Mike Trout walked up with his family, and then my dream moves from that point out to a ball field. I'm standing out kind of in a big open field, and I hear you and Eduardo doing a game. You're analyzing a game in the background as I'm standing out in the ball field, and then all of a sudden the ball field transforms into a football field with really high grass, and in that game you become a running back and you got lost in the high grass. And I'm not kidding, that's 100% true of what I dreamed last night. What do you think about all that?
Well, first off, you got to get some help, Buster. That's a disturbing dream. The only part of it that makes any sense is me getting lost in the tall grass, which has happened before, by the way. And for to be in the same dream as you and Mike Trout and Eduardo Perez, that's pretty cool. I get it. And, you know, I love doing games with Eduardo from the booth, and we get to continue to do that now that he didn't get the Mets job. All right, I'm going to give this a little bit of thought today. I'm not sure where the Trout thing enters, but I'll figure that out. I'll try to decipher what that dream was all about.
Yeah, Troy, I'll bring in here on this. I'll let you sort of translate the stream. To me, it's pretty obvious. We are lost in the midst of this football season while we're waiting for baseball. And, Tim, that's embodied by you getting lost in the high grass. Troy, do you buy that?
I think I agree with Tim and that you need some help.
Tim, do you agree with how I'm breaking that down? I think that's just we're lost in the muddle of the football season.
Yes, I have not understood anything about football till when they went to the nickel package. And now I have no idea what a bubble screen is. I used to love and know a little bit about football. Now I'm completely lost even in the terminology, and now apparently I'm lost in the grass also.
All right. Well, baseball has its own developing terminology. We'll get to that when we talk about the Astros scandal. But let's start with the Hall of Fame ballot that was released yesterday. For the most part, I think you would agree with me, it's cut and dried about who's getting in the Hall of Fame. Derek Jeter will get in. One of my questions about this year's ballot is, will he get in as a unanimous selection? Tim, I sure as heck would hope so.
Well, I would hope so also. There can be no reason not to vote for him. Now, in some years, Buster, as you know, people leave a great player off, an obvious Hall of Famer off, to get some other guys in when there are 10 absolutely worthy Hall of Famers, but I'm not sure that's the case this year. So I'm not sure there is an excuse to not vote for Derek Jeter. Maybe people will then follow the Mariano Rivera lead and say, all right, this is the right thing to do. The precedent has been set. My guess is someone won't vote for him for some reason or another. But I cannot come up with a reason not to vote for Derek Jeter. He's one of the 2, 3, 4 greatest shortstops of all time. He's one of the 5, 6 greatest Yankees of all time. I'm not sure there's a way around not voting for him.
No, and look, I'm on social media more than you are, but I was shocked yesterday by how even professionals, folks in our industry, were basically saying, yeah, okay, he was a really great player, but he wasn't an elite player. And I'm looking at it, and I get it, that, you know, maybe he wasn't an all-time leader in home runs. He certainly was not an elite defensive player. Tim, he had 1,923 runs. That's the 11th highest all-time. He had 3,465 hits. That's the sixth most all-time. Among players who spent their whole career with one team, only one player had more, Stan Musial. He did have all those moments. He did set all those records in the postseason. So I don't know how you can give him demerits for being around a long time.
I'm not even going to engage in this, Buster. That's ridiculous to consider him just a compiler when he won all those rings, hit over 300 lifetime, has more hits than Willie Mays. Postseason record is ridiculously good.
Yes.
And I don't care about the defense. I understand. And I've been told he wasn't as good as people think he was defensively. I just know all the games that I watched with my own two eyes, I would rather have it hit to him late in the game than anybody. That counts for something. So I'm just not going there. If you want to, you don't want to vote for him to put somebody else on, that's fine. But there is no other reason not to vote for Derek Jeter.
And I got to tell you this, too. I think some of the people who would absolutely support him as an elite player would be those Red Sox teams that he competed against. You know, I've been in the same room as Theo Epstein and Jed Hoyer and Terry Francona, and Red Sox players talk about how in awe they were of him. Like, he was the guy that they were always feared in a big moment that he would come through with a big hit.
Right. And Buck Martinez, when he managed the Blue Jays, told me that Derek Jeter is the captain of the Yankees because you can hear him run to first base every single time. And maybe that doesn't mean much, but I think with all that we have today, wondering, our guys running hard all the time, that guy ran hard every single time in his entire major league career, and that matters, at least it does to me.
Okay, some of the other ballot storylines, we're all going to be watching the progression of Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds. This is year 9 of their eligibility on the ballot. You, of course, can get 10 years. The last 4 years, they have crawled. They've gone from 49% to 53% to 56% to 59%. Tim, I still think that's a long way away from 75%. And I don't expect them to get in this year, and I still think that it's going to have to take a shift of thought among those who haven't voted for them for those guys to actually get in. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree that they have a long way to go. And others have gone that far in a 2-year period, but obviously they don't have the baggage that Clemens and Bonds have. I have voted for them every year. It is never an easy vote, but I vote for them every year. I'm planning on voting for them again. But I think they have too long to go, too far to go, and I think there are enough people out there, voters out there, who say if you have a connection to performance-enhancing drugs, you're not getting my vote. And so I don't see them getting close to 75 this year. I think they'll get a spike because it's not the greatest Hall of Fame year that we've seen in recent years. So we'll see where it goes from there.
If there's going to be a player from the writer's ballot standing next to Derek Jeter on the stage at Cooperstown next year, I think the guy who has the best chance is Larry Walker. Last year, he got 54.6%. Just 5 years ago, Tim, he was polling in the range of about 10 to 11%. But you got the sense yesterday that there's a type of momentum building behind his candidacy that worked on behalf of Edgar Martinez. This is Larry Walker's last year on the ballot. I think he's going to get across. What do you think?
I'm going to vote for him again. I don't think he's going to get across this year, and I frankly hope I'm wrong. He still has to get an enormous boost in the final year, and my guess is he's not going to have enough traction to do that. Guys have come this far in the final year and made it, but my guess is he's going to come up just short, which I think is unfortunate. Those numbers are ridiculous. He's also one of the great base runners we've ever seen, one of the great defensive right fielders, one of the great throwing right fielders we've ever seen. A career OPS is so unbelievably high. He should be in the Hall of Fame, and I hope I'm wrong. I think he's going to get into the 70s and not make it to 75.
Okay, let's have a bet on this one, whether or not Larry Walker gets in. And again, to be clear, you are going to vote for him. If I still voted, I would also vote for him this year. But you don't think because you believe he has too far to go. Tim, I think he's going to get in. And part of the reason why is I think the election last year of Harold Baines, while I understand that was on a Veterans Committee ballot, I think that changes a lot as we move forward for a lot of these candidates. It's part of the reason why I think Larry Walker gets in. Does that make sense? And the reason why I want to bet you a dinner in spring training over Larry Walker, whether or not he gets voted in this year.
Okay, Buster. The last time you bought me dinner, you told me it was such a great restaurant, and I dropped my tray and everything. It was terrible. So, yes, we'll have another bet this year for dinner in spring training, and I hope you win the bet because I think he's a Hall of Famer and I think he belongs in.
Does my Harold Baines rationale make sense to you?
Yes, and I think that Harold Baines rationale is also going to affect the vote this year with Dwight Evans and some other Don Mattingly and Steve Garvey and some other guys on the ballot this year because Harold Baines' election is going to change a lot of things, and maybe you're right. Maybe it will change it for Larry Walker.
Curt Schilling last year, 8 years, his eighth year in the ballot, he went to 60.9%. I'm guessing that he doesn't get in this year, but he will jump into the 70% range. I get the feeling that some voters who maybe penalized him a few years for his social media, some of the stuff he tweets out, are starting to back off that, and eventually he gets in. What do you think?
Yeah, I think he eventually gets in. I think he's going to get in on the writer's ballot. I don't think he's going to get in this year on the writer's ballot. But you look at some other pitchers, really good pitchers who've gotten in recent years. Curt Schilling is right there with all of them. And, you know, we talk about, you know, Justin Verlander, Zach Greinke, CC Sabathia, and all these guys who are still active. Are they going to make it to the Hall of Fame? Curt Schilling is right there with all of those guys, basically. So I think he gets in, but I think it takes the full 10 years.
All right, let's talk about what's going on with the Houston Astros, Major League Baseball's investigation of sign stealing. One of the narratives, and you see it a lot with Astros fans, are saying, well, everybody does this. Tim, I got to tell you, I've talked to enough people in the game that, yes, some people might try to do it to some degree, but not everybody was doing it to the extent of what we think the Astros were doing, which, you know, has been brought out not only, you know, by Mike Fiers, the first story by The Athletic, but the great reporting by Jeff Passan for us. John Boy, I'm sure you've seen the video where you could hear the audio of something being banged, probably a trash can, it sounds like, to tip off the hitter to the identity of the forthcoming pitch, which matches up with what you've heard from other teams the last 2 years, where they would say that when you played the Astros, there were all these strange noises. So I don't buy that every team was doing what the Astros were doing. What about you?
Yeah, I'm with you on this, Buster. I've talked to a lot of people in the game also, and one guy told me he thinks a third of the teams are set up to do exactly what the Astros are accused of doing. But he said the Astros have taken this to a completely different level. So I'm just quoting a guy who might or might not know exactly what happened here, but that's the way he views this. And yes, teams are doing all sorts of things to steal signs all the time. But obviously when electronics are involved, technology is involved, and you take it to a different level, then that's the difference. And that's where the commissioner is now in a really tricky spot on, if all of this is true, what is the penalty? How does he discipline the Astros? Because maybe he'll find out we're wrong, that they're doing it and other teams are doing the same thing. But the people I've talked to have told me something different, that yes, other teams are, you know, doing something here, but not nearly to the extent that what the Astros are accused of doing.
Yeah, I think that what other teams are doing is they're going and looking at video and watching, you know, videotape of opposing pitchers in previous games, and they're determining, okay, the guy's tipping his pitches this way, or maybe when they get a runner at second base, they're more aggressive in trying to get the sign back to the hitter. But in real time, which has been borne out by what Mike Fiers was saying and by the videotape that John Boy put out on Twitter, that is something that I don't think that many other teams, if any, are doing in terms of what the Astros are doing. You mentioned the commissioner. I wrote a column the other day basically saying that the commissioner has to come down hard. He has to come down big way with penalties, not only because he needs to, I think, underscore the integrity of the competition going on and you know, to move baseball away from cheating. But, Tim, I feel like that the Astros in particular have basically thumbed their nose at the commissioner's office with their actions. When you think about it, you consider the timeline of some of the discipline that's gone on from Major League Baseball, I think it's pretty clear that the Astros just ignored the dictum. Look, in 2017 of August of that year, the Red Sox and the Yankees had their flare-up over the Apple Watches. On September 15th of 2017, the commissioner put out a disciplinary decision where they fined the Red Sox, they fined the Yankees less money, and they said, if anybody does this going forward, we're really going to come down and it might cost teams draft picks. And it was after that that the Astros were allegedly doing this. I think that, and we saw again in 2018 when they played the Indians, they stationed an employee next to the Indians' dugout. Jeff Luhnow, their general manager, acknowledged it, and he's saying, well, we were playing defense. We weren't playing offense. Come on. The commissioner, I think, has to come down hard on these teams because he's got to establish the power of his office, because it's clear, as I wrote in the piece, that I feel like teams are treating him like a high school crossing guard, laughing at him as they ignored what he was saying. What do you think?
Well, there's an arrogance about the Astros that people have told me about for years now, that we're the Astros, we're smarter than everyone else, we do things differently than everyone else, and we're reinventing the way you evaluate a team and a player, and we're way ahead of everyone else. And there's certainly some truth to that, but that arrogance is something that needs to be put in line, and maybe that's what the commissioner needs to do here. I think you've overstated it slightly with Rob Manfred, I think, but I do agree. He has to do something very big here. My question to you, Buster, is, because I've been over this with people in baseball, what is the penalty if this is true? I had one person tell me in the game, said, you have to do something to make winning harder for the Astros in 2020. So taking away a draft choice in 2023 is not going to affect them this year. For the life of me, I cannot figure out how you can make life more difficult, make wins harder to come by for the Astros in 2020. How do you do that? What is the penalty? I've asked a bunch of people this, and I can't get a consensus, and I can't get an answer that is absolutely right, at least in my mind.
Yeah, I think it's major suspensions. If you determine that there were people in authority in the loop, then they have to face major suspensions. And I think it's got to be beyond the 3 to 5 day thing, Tim. And I wrote about this in the piece on Sunday as well, that I you can bet that Rob Manfred probably feels like the parent of teenagers, where he's saying, do I really need to tell you people not to fudge medical records, like A.J. Preller, the Padres GM, and he wound up giving him 30 days? Or do I really need to tell a team like the Cardinals not to hack into the computer system of the Astros? Or, you know, in the case of the Braves, do I really need, after we get a draft slotting system, to tell the Braves not to cheat in the international market? But I do feel like that his tendency to go with financial penalties rather than really harsh personal penalties at the highest level of each organization maybe has emboldened some of these teams to feel like, you know what, even if we do this, there aren't really going to be ramifications. I think that clearly happened in the case of the Astros.
Yes. So you're talking about a 6-month suspension. Is that what you're talking about?
I'm not comfortable putting days on it because I don't have access to all the information. But if you found that a team willfully blew past the rules that you put in place, then I think suspending an administrator for a year is not out of the question. Like, I think you should make it where you scare people, because you and I both know this, that if you were to tell people, look, if you use technology to alter the playing field and cheat the other team, we're going to give you a year suspension. Tim, it would end. Like, there's no way that some, you know, video technician or some player is going to risk getting a sign on one pitch in a game in September or October risked the possibility of being suspended for a year. It would end. And I wrote a year ago I thought that's what Rob should do.
Yeah, and I agree, Buster. The financial part of it is it's just not enough. A hefty fine is not going to be enough for a team such as the Astros or any team because they'll figure out a way to afford that. But you start suspending people, I think that changes everything. And getting back to the original point here, Buster, the difference in this story is we have an on-the-record baseball yes. player saying this is what happened. And he was supported off the record by several others. And I like to think I know Mike Fiers well enough that he's a reputable guy, a credible guy. And it's interesting that we've got someone on the record talking about this, which I think adds additional credibility to it.
Okay, the one big player move made so far this offseason, the Braves signing closer Will Smith to a three-year deal. I like the signing, Tim, and I think it really sets up the Braves for a very comfortable offseason because they got their big work out of the way, and I suspect other teams would be looking to do the same. What did you think of the Braves signing of their closer?
Well, Will Smith had a great year. He has a slider when he throws it right that nobody can hit, and they needed some help in that bullpen for sure. They got knocked out of the playoffs not because their bullpen let them down, but I would not be comfortable with the Braves opening next season trying to win another division in a very difficult division now without some help in the bullpen, and the Braves added that in a left-hander who is really, really good. And I'm not sold that they're completely done with their offseason either. I think they could use another starting pitcher, even though they have a pretty nice rotation as it is. But Will Smith is a great start, and I'd like to think even if they don't do anything else, or if they do one more thing, re-sign Donaldson maybe, they're going to be the team to beat in that division again.
Yeah, and they're going to be involved in the conversations as well for catcher Yasmani Grandal, so we'll see where that goes. All right, Tim, my therapist, I'm sure, will be in touch with you very quickly.
Watch out for your dreams, Buster. I have more weird ones than anyone, but they don't involve grass over my head, although they're a similar one.
Mark Teixeira played 14 years in the big leagues. He's now an analyst for Baseball Tonight for ESPN. And Tex, how you doing? You enjoying the offseason?
I am, Buster. Looking forward to the winter meetings here soon, but all's good.
Nice. And all is not good for the Houston Astros. They're under investigation. Just before you and I started talking, Rob Manfred, the baseball commissioner, addressed reporters saying that at this time, Major League Baseball has no information that this extends beyond what the Astros have done. As someone who played a long time in the big leagues, when you started to see the details of this and you saw what Mike Fiers said after playing the Astros in 2017, what was your reaction?
You know, I'm not surprised that a team would try to bend the rules or go as much up to the line as possible without crossing it. But I am surprised that it seems like they did cross the line here, Buster. And, you know, teams have been trying to figure out signs from catchers for years. This is not new at all. Technology has definitely helped. But I thought since what happened with the Red Sox back in 2017 and even the Astros last year, with kind of some slaps on the wrist to say, hey, guys, no technology needed, I am surprised that they went over the line, allegedly, and kind of used extra cameras and kind of real-time noises in the dugout to relay these signs.
Yeah, and it was the real-time use of technology that seems to be the separator because, I mean, when you played, how much conversation was there among teammates about trying to steal signs or relay them to the hitter from the base runner at second base or maybe something that a first base coach would pick up in what the catcher was doing?
So it really started the last few years of my career. I'm not saying that there wasn't sign stealing or guys trying to pick up on pitchers tipping, but for me, it really wasn't until we had better technology. You know, we had a video guy that was a full-time staff member because I just don't think that there was enough man hours on the coaching staff to try to figure out signs and try to relay them that quickly. So it was really probably maybe 2012, 13, and I was never a guy that liked knowing what was coming. I wanted to clear my head, see the ball, hit the ball, And if a team, if we really knew what a guy was throwing and could relay him from second base, we did that. But I actually pushed back on teammates or coaches trying to shove it down our throats, because the fact is, as soon as the opposing team thinks you have their signs, they're changing it. And now that crutch that you thought you had, like, oh, you know, I'm not going to get a hit unless I know it's coming, that gets taken away. I just didn't think it was good for a team, so I tried to stay away from it personally.
So how much did other teammates that you have, could they use that? You mentioned, how much did they like having that information relative to how you felt?
You know, really, I don't think it helped that much, Buster. I really don't. And I think numbers will show you that. I think if you look at the Astros this year, when they played at home in the postseason, they were awful with runners in scoring position. So if they did, in fact, have the signs, that means just they're that bad of hitters, and the two don't add up. These are really good hitters that the Astros have on their team. And apparently they had signs or had a method of gaining signs, but obviously weren't that good at either relaying them or getting them in the first place, because they were terrible with runners in scoring position. And I played on plenty of teams that we thought we could gain an advantage by stealing signs, and we stunk with runners in scoring position. So I think it gets in your head more than anything. Baseball is a reaction sport. And the last thing a hitter needs is to go up to the plate saying, well, I'm 80% sure this is going to be an off-speed pitch, so let me sit on this. Or, hey, did that guy at second, does he have the sign? Or, you know, from the Astros case, if they're banging on something in the dugout, well, was that just somebody dropping their bat, or did I hear, you know, the signal? So I think it messes guys up more than anything.
Yeah, I was going to ask, because you've seen the video John Boy sent out. He tweeted out the video of Evan Gattis, batting against Danny Farquhar. And I was wondering, from the hitter's perspective, because I know you referenced how you didn't like having that in your head, how quickly you could process that information with the pitcher in his set position, and just as he starts to go into his pitching motion, you start to hear the banging. How quickly could you process that as a hitter?
Some guys are better than others, but again, for me, I never liked it. It's so hard to hit a baseball, Buster. I mean, we know how tough it is. The best players in baseball go on 0 for 20 streaks. So, you know, you're locked in. You're really focusing on seeing a good pitch, you know, putting the barrel on it. You add any information that is variable information, thinking, well, maybe it's an off-speed, or maybe this is a fastball. I still don't know location. Or, wait a second, did we talk about location? And now your head starts spinning, and it's going to be very difficult to hit. So, again, you know, we can debate the merits of whether knowing certain pitches are coming helps or not. The fact of the matter is, if the Astros stepped over the line and used technology that they knew they weren't supposed to use, and used ways of relaying that information that were illegal against the rules, then something major has to happen.
Yeah, you saw the tweet from Aaron Judge. I think the words he used were, wait, what? When the first story broke that he sent out, Kevin Gausman, the pitcher formerly the Orioles, the Braves, the Cincinnati Reds, tweeted out, hey, jobs were lost. If you had played on the 2017 Yankees, for example, and you had lost to the Astros, or if you played on the Dodgers and you had lost to the Astros, how do you think you would have felt?
Well, I mean, listen, I think people that live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. I think every single team tries to do this. The issue is, as we just said, the issue is the Astros just stepped over the line, right? So let's make sure that every team out there is going to get a full investigation for the next year before people start saying, well, I lost a job or I lost a game, because I guarantee you the Astros are not the only team out there that stepped over the line. That being said, I think the same can be said when you hear of players that took steroids that were on World
right.
Series teams. Right? And this is a conversation that we've had privately in the past. You know, show me a team over the last 15 years that hasn't had a player that took steroids or were currently on steroids on that team that won a World Series, and I'll say, let's start taking away rings. But unfortunately, and I hate it, I hate players cheating. I hate that the Astros did this. I hate that players took steroids. Unfortunately, that's baseball. And until Major League Baseball really comes down hard on this type of cheating, teams and players are going to keep trying to do it.
That's what I just said to Tim. I talked to him a little while ago, and I mentioned to him that I feel like that. You mentioned the wrist slap on the Red Sox and the Yankees when that investigation went on with the Apple Watch, and then the Yankees found to have used their phone illicitly, according to Major League Baseball. I feel like that perhaps, and certainly not intentionally, Rob Manfred may have emboldened some of the teams that were doing this stuff, because that happened right in the middle of when the Astros were allegedly cheating, and they just said, okay, we're just going to keep going. And I feel like to restore not only the integrity of the competition, but also the power of his office, I think Rob's got to be compelled to come down big time with a hammer, because if he throws out, let's say he suspends someone in the chain of command with the Astros for a year or for half a season, that would end this, in my opinion. Just having known players through the years, they're not going to risk their career. They're not going to risk a season of their career to participate in something like that if that's what the penalty is. What do you think?
I agree, Buster. And at the same time, I don't blame Rob and Major League Baseball for not coming down harder the first time. And this is the reason. I think especially in baseball, when rules are bent and that line is, you know, people go right up to that line without trying to cross it, it's part of the DNA of baseball. And the first offense, you know, maybe it should be a wrist slap, but it should be a warning. I mean, there should have been a memo, and maybe there was. There should have been a memo that next time something like this happens, we are going to come down hard. I was on the team, I believe it was 2014 or 2015, Michael Pineda had pine tar on his neck at Fenway. And it's on national television. I believe it was the ESPN Sunday night. And the entire world saw this gob of pine tar on Michael Pineda's neck. Now, Michael Pineda didn't get suspended for the season. He got suspended for 5 or 10 games. What's the reason? Every pitcher out there uses some sort of substance. And so, Rob and MLB, they can't go out there and just go scorched earth the first time somebody gets caught. But what they can do is say, listen, guys, I know all of you are trying this. I know you're all doing it in your own little way, but this is the first warning. You know, 5 or 10 game suspension, a slap on the wrist, a draft pick or whatever it might be. That's the first warning. The next time something like this happens and you defy my orders and Major League Baseball's rules, there are going to be serious consequences.
And I feel like that along those lines, that the penalties for people in the chain of command in the administration, if it's found they've had knowledge, and Jeff Passan, great story the other day, mentioned how Kevin Goldstein, who works in the Astros front office, sent a note out to scouts saying, hey, we're looking for this information. If you get someone in the front office or in the coaching staff who's found to be in the chain of custody for this stuff, for lack of a better way to describe it, to me, the penalty for that type of person in that position would be even greater. What do you think?
I agree, because every player is going to do whatever it takes for him to succeed and for his team to win a game. So players will do whatever it takes. It's up to the adults in the room to say, hey, guys, I understand we're trying to relay signs and steal signs, but these are the rules. And so if an executive or any team official not only doesn't call out players or coaches that are stepping over the line, but actually encourages that type of behavior, they need to be fired and banned from baseball. I mean, it's the same thing if a banker from Goldman Sachs sends out an email to his traders, hey, guys, let's look for inside information so we can beat the stock market. That doesn't fly in the real world. And I think baseball is starting to realize, as did football with Spygate and Deflategate and those type of things, and certain other things that have happened in sports, that the media is gonna pick up on every little thing that happens. Technology is getting so much better. We have pretty much everything is recorded. I saw the clip of the Astros 2017 World Series DVD or video that said, that showed Jose Altuve walking up the steps and then taking down the monitor that was right there. Those little things, you're not going to get away with that type of stuff. And so I just think that the adults in the room, the executives, need to step in if rules are being broken.
And there's also the practical reality, and you and I both know this, that for Major League Baseball to go hard after players for participating in this, they would have to go through the union. For administrators, for staffers, it's different. They can come down with a hammer without having to deal with the union repercussions. All right, I want to ask you about Gerrit Cole and his negotiations, because I've had some agents suggest to me in the last couple of days, and this is just them theorizing. Scott Boras represents Gerrit Cole. They believe that you might see a Yankees lightning strike. Well, they will work to try to get Gerrit Cole off the board as quickly as possible, which, of course, would run counter the way we've seen free agency the last couple of years, where Bryce Harper doesn't sign till February, Manny Machado doesn't sign till late, because their feeling is that Brian Cashman, the Yankees general manager, had this long history of just absolutely shocking people by going in and without any, you know, stories, leaks that he's meeting with this person or meeting with that person and then grabbing the player overnight. Your case was an example of that. I know CeCe Sabathia, that was an example of that. Johnny Damon, before you guys, was an example of that. First off, could you see that happening? And how does Brian Cashman negotiate a lightning strike like that?
So, Buster, I think the most important thing for everyone to understand is the Yankees are never out of a player. They're never out of a negotiation because they have more money than anybody. And so when it comes to a couple million here or there or an extra year or even two, the Yankees are always going to be in that conversation. And so in my case, I believe we started in earnest talking the second week of November. So, you know, right around this time, we started talking to the Yankees, and they didn't even make – Brian Cashman didn't even make an offer. But he told Scott Boras, listen, when you're ready to make a decision, call me. And I truly believe that same conversation just happened with Scott Boras and Brian Cashman saying, hey, Scott, like, I'm not going to bid up your guy, but know that I have more money than everybody. Call me before he signs. And I think that's the way that Brian Cashman does these, you know, laser strikes, as you call them, or just kind of, you know, in the middle of the night deals, because every agent knows if they don't call the Yankees before their client signs, they might be leaving money on the table. Because especially this year, with how important Gerrit Cole is to the Yankees offseason, they won't get outbid. The question is, if the Yankees truly want Gerrit Cole, they can give him 10 years and $400 million. They can do that. The question is what are other teams willing to do? And the Yankees don't want to bid against themselves during this process.
Where do you think Gerrit Cole is going to sign with that all said?
I still, for some reason, I don't think he's going to the Yankees. That's just a gut. I don't have any inside information on that. You're way better at that stuff than I am. I just have a feeling that Gerrit Cole first of all, he's already made a bunch of money, right? So a couple million bucks here and there won't be a big deal. Playing in New York is not for everybody. And maybe Gerrit Cole will thrive in New York. But if you told me, as the top free agent on the market, and I'm a West Coast guy, and the Dodgers and Angels are sitting there drooling over me, I'm probably going to look there before I look at the Yankees. Again, it's not the easiest place to play. And, I mean, Gerrit Cole, he can write his own check right now. The question is, if the Yankees did something crazy and got to $350 or $400 million, then you almost can't turn it down, right? So I think money being equal, he's not going to the Yankees. If the Yankees completely blow everyone out of the water, then he'll end up in pinstripes.
So basically using the CeCe Sabathia playbook, knowing that CeCe at that time, fall of 2008, California guy, wants to play for the Dodgers, wants to play for the Angels. The Angels offer him $100 million. Scott Boras tells them the Yankees, Brian Peters, his agent, tells the Yankees, look, you're basically going to have a New York surcharge, and so they offer him 161. I think that's the one way the Yankees can get him. If their offer's like, and I'm with you, let's pull a big number out, $300 million, $320 million out, and the next biggest one is $250, the Yankees have to separate themselves.
I agree with that. You look at what is important for players nowadays, and it used to be that the Yankees were one of only a handful of teams that were on TV all the time and had the big payroll, and you could get your brand out there and you could, you know, whatever, be a star. You can be a star anywhere. Now, you won't be as big of a star in L.A. I think Mike Trout will show you that. He's the greatest player in maybe two generations, and he's still not a big national star. But Mike Trout is happy as a clam. I mean, this guy gets to play in beautiful weather with great fans that support him even when they don't make the playoffs. You go to Yankee Stadium and have a bad start, your first start out, you're going to get booed. And do you really want to sign up for that? Some players love it. You know, when I played for the Yankees, man, our highs were amazing. No high or high. When it's low and you're injured or you're not performing and the team doesn't make the playoffs, there's nothing worse. So I think Gerrit Cole is going to take all that into account, and then his agent's going to say, yeah, Gerrit, but they're going to give you $50 million more. And that's going to be the question, you know, for Gerrit Cole is, or and the Yankees, by the way, are they willing to do that?
Gerrit Cole went to high school less than 4 miles from Angel Stadium. He was born less than 20 miles from Angel Stadium. So it's I agree with you. It just comes down ultimately to what Gerrit Cole really wants in his heart. Tex, thanks for doing this, and I'll see you out in San Diego.
Always fun, Buster.
Bleacher Tweets.
All right, Buster. Bleacher Tweets. Here we go. I've missed them. The first one this morning comes from Davies Lineup at Davies Lineup 2. How would the new proposal eliminating the minor league teams work? Would MLB teams only have certain levels of minor league affiliation?
Yeah, we're waiting for more details on this. I'm sure, Troy, you've seen this story. I think it was Baseball America that first reported on it, and then there was a breakdown in the New York Times the other day about specific teams that are in jeopardy being dropped by Major League Baseball under this plan to trim the number of minor league teams by about 40. And I got to tell you, just at the face of it, and I've made a couple calls on this, I kind of don't get it. You know, what I've been told is that if a major league team drops a minor league team, they would trim about $1 million in cost. So you think about it this way. This is a $10 billion industry, according to the numbers of Major League Baseball has forwarded. And if they do this, they follow through with this plan, they would save about $40 million, right? That's not very much money for a $10 billion
right.
industry. And I wonder if it would be more effective for Major League Baseball just to keep these teams in place, you know, to keep exposure of their product, its seed money, interest in the sport in those areas. And I also wouldn't want to feed into the narrative that anything is falling back for Major League Baseball.
Right.
What do you think, Troy?
Yeah, exactly. I know if I were a fan living in the areas where a team would get cut, I would not be happy about it because oftentimes in those places, you're really far away from a major league team. And that is how, if you're MLB, you can keep a fan's interest in the game because they'll often be attached to the major league team of the affiliate that you are close by. So it would kill a lot of fans' interest in the game and also a lot of players and, you know, young boys and girls who want to be professional ball players that their dreams often end in those levels. And if they never even get the chance, then that just kills some people's hopes and dreams, which I don't want.
And let's put this number into context. And I believe, you know, because I heard this from a couple of different teams, that this plan would save, if you cut a minor league team, it saves an organization about $1 million. That's about what Gerrit Cole's going to make for pitching six innings in 2020. Okay? We're not talking about a huge amount of dollars. I kind of wonder if this is a penny-wise, pound-foolish type conversation, but I'm going to do some more digging into it.
Yeah, I certainly look forward to when we can talk to Keith Law about it. The next tweet today comes from Matthew Roy at MTR Sports J. What happens with Mookie Betts this offseason, and what can the Red Sox get for him?
Well, and that's what it'll come down to, because what I've heard from other teams is that given the fact that Mookie's going to make somewhere in the range of $28 to $30 million in salary arbitration this winter, they don't think the Red Sox will get much more than, you know, one good prospect, not an elite prospect. They're not going to get a Fernando Tatis Jr. type prospect for him. They'll get a good prospect, maybe a few other pieces. But that's eventually, you know, that sort of return is what scared off the Orioles from trading Manny Machado in the winter before he became a free agent. I think it's more likely the Red Sox would say, you know what, given the low return that we would get, we'll keep Mookie going into 2020. And if we're out of the race, then we'll talk about dealing him next summer and maybe we'll get a little bit more because we'll be trading him to a contender.
So since our last podcast, we've had awards announced. And so this question from Johnny Cappadino at J Super Scout has to do with the MVP conversation. So Buster, is no denying the Mike Trout's talent, but he only played in 62 Angels wins in 2019. Alex Bregman, on the other hand, led his team to 107 wins with Jose Altuve, George Springer, and Carlos Correa missing significant time. The difference in meaningful games is astounding.
Yeah, that whole value thing, that I think the voters get hung up on that too much, and I really hope that the MVP conversation goes more toward just pick the best player, because everyone gets hung up on that word valuable. Well, they'll say, well, you know, Bregman played in games that had a lot more value than what Mike Trout had. Okay, how about the games in April when the Angels play the Astros? Are you telling me that the games are valuable for the Astros, but they're not for the Angels? It feels like a slippery slope that you're going to go down. Just pick the best player. Mike Trout was clearly the best player. That said, if Bregman had won the award, I would have had no problem with that. Because clearly, you know, the fact that Trout was limited to 20 plate appearances in September could be a factor in the eyes of some voters.
Plus, I'm not sure if Andrelton Simmons is getting any trash cans banged to alert Mike Trout what pitch is coming.
Cheap shots.
Next one from Kirk Fatul at Kirk Fatul. From 2009 to 2019, only three teams haven't made the playoffs, those being the White Sox, Padres, and Marlins. Of the three, which has the best chance of making the playoffs in 2020?
Troy, the answer is obvious to me. What about you?
I think you're going to say the White Sox, because yep. I know you're really high on them for next year.
Well, I don't know if I'm necessarily high on them. They certainly have potential, but I think the context is so much better for them in the American League Central. Think about this. The Padres finished last year 36 games behind the Dodgers. That is a long way to go, where the White Sox, I don't think, have as far to go, because they're in the American League Central, and the Marlins are in a team with four other contenders in their division. That's going to be a problem.
Agreed. Well, the Padres, they certainly have some exciting talent with Machado, and Tatis Jr. will hopefully be
36 games.
Yeah, I know. So I agree with your pick with the White Sox there. But thank you for the Bleacher tweets, guys. Keep them coming all throughout the off season. We'll be doing these podcasts throughout the off season, so keep them coming. Use the hashtag Bleacher tweets.
And Troy, I'm thinking we'll have one the week after Thanksgiving, and then I'll talk to you about doing, you know, potentially a daily one if there's news to justify it from the winter meetings. So we'll have the podcast, this podcast, and then we'll have another one the week after Thanksgiving. Does that sound good?
Okay, week after Thanksgiving, I should be awake from my food coma by then.
Not if you ate my mashed potatoes. My thanks today to Tim Kirkchen, to Mark Teixeira, to Troy Farkas. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.